You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 21.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Hi, I'm Dom Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Today, we're discussing the 2015 Christmas special, The Husbands of River Song. Joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika from Malta, Montana. Hi, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Great. And also Stephanie Zimmer from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello, hello.
And Jimmy Akin from San Diego, California. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom. How's it going?
It's great. So it's been a while since we've been together to record an episode. After our last episode, a marathon recording of the season finale, two-episode season finale. We'll try to keep it a little shorter this time and get right into it. But first, there's a bit of Doctor Who news. Stephanie, there was something new that came across the wires, so to speak, about a future of something related to Doctor Who.
Well, it's not exactly new. It came out in October, but I was doing research for my other podcast looking for news and had seen that BBC America talked about this Doctor Who spinoff that they were going to be airing sometime in 2016. So apparently it is officially coming. We don't have a specific air date for it, but it will be coming out sometime this year. So it's a spinoff that's called Class. It'll have 8 episodes, 45 minutes long. It's a spinoff from the acclaimed young adult author, Patrick Ness, and it's called Class. It's a young adult series set in contemporary London. Incredible dangers are breaking through the walls of time and space, and with darkness coming, London is unprotected. With all the action, heart, and adrenaline of the best young adult fiction, this is Coal Hill School and Doctor Who like you've never seen it before, which is from the press release. I did not make that up, so it sounds pretty interesting. I think it should be pretty fun to see.
So it sounds like Teenage Torchwood.
Yes,
pretty much.
that could be so very different. So Coal Hill School—that's Clara's school where she taught. We had talked about this in a previous episode when the first speculation came out about it. This is solid news now that that's actually happening, and now we know that it is going to be Coal Hill School, presumably. Some of the characters we saw from those episodes set at the school this season, last season.
One that we haven't seen that I would love to see them bring back in this series is the, I guess he's the head of the school now, Ian Chesterton. He was one of the original companions of Doctor Who back in 1963. He was actually an awesome companion. He was a really good companion. The actor is still alive, and if they were able to work him into the series, I think that would be great.
Well, I think there's been some hope because, yeah, there's a scene in one of the actually, I think it's the 50th anniversary episode, as I'm looking at the picture of it, where it shows the Coal Hill sign and it says Chairman of the Governors, I. Chesterton.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's been real a hope that they bring Ian in for somehow because, yeah, the actor's in his 90s. He's like mid-90s, but he's still out there. I believe he's still even acting a little bit. Mm-hmm. So he would be available to do it, but it would just be great to see that connection back 50 years.
Yeah. Back then he was kind of the action man on the show since the original Doctor was an older gentleman. And so Ian took on more of the action duties. So he obviously wouldn't be doing those today, but it'd still be nice to see him.
Mm. And even if probably, at 90, probably not running around with the school kids, but at least in a few scenes here or there, that would be very interesting to see. That's great. And it's not the first Doctor Who spinoff. We mentioned Torchwood. There have been others. The Sarah Jane Chronicles.
Mm-hmm. Canine and Company.
Canine and Company. That's a new one to me. That would be interesting to see. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. It's good news that American fans will be able to watch it on BBC America. So that's also good news. Great. So that's about all we have for news, isn't it? Or Father Corey, was there something?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you there for, for a while.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. Make sure my Skype is working. But
I heard him fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You just sorry about that.
It's just a Montana-based internet glitch. I think.
Yeah. You know, the cows we have hauling the bits are acting up.
So, I was just saying that it's good news that American fans will be able to watch this on the BBC America if they so choose, while we're waiting for a new season of Doctor Who to show up in our DVR queues. So moving on from that, it's Christmas. As liturgically speaking, at least in the Catholic Church, we've just finished celebrating Christmas yesterday as we record this on the Feast of the Baptism of the Lord. But we're talking about the Christmas episode of Doctor Who, an annual tradition, and it goes back to the very first Doctor. Jimmy, you have something to share with us from that time, from the very first Christmas episode.
Yeah, so back in 1965, Doctor Who was airing almost every week during the year, and it wasn't like now where we have only 13 episodes a year. They had like 40, 50 episodes a year, and in 1965, that episode for the week happened to fall on December 25th, so it was an actual on Christmas Day episode, first time that had happened, and they did something unusual to commemorate it. At the time, they were airing a big 12, 13-part story called The Daleks' Master Plan. And the Daleks, you know, were at the height of their popularity. They had this evil plan to take over the universe in the future. But they didn't really want to have a lot of Dalek menace exterminate stuff going on Christmas Day. And so they took a break from the Dalek plot, and the Doctor and his two companions, Stephen and Sarah, both of whom were from the future, ended up on the TARDIS with the Doctor. They traveled to 1965. Where they ended up in a police station on Christmas Day, and there was a bunch of comedy with the TARDIS appearing as a police box of the kind that was then in use, and the actual police. Then there was they ended up traveling again to a silent movie studio where they were filming all these melodramas, you know, women about to be sawn in half in a lumber mill and stuff like that. And the companions from the future didn't realize what was going on. They thought all this was real. And so you have them kind of stumbling around this silent movie studio in slapstick fashion, adding a lot of comedy for the episode. And then they finally escape from that. They get back on the TARDIS. And they're going, wow, what was that? What was going on there? I have no idea. I hope we never land there again, though. And at that moment, the Doctor brings out a tray with some drinks on it, and he gives them to Sarah and Stephen and tells them Happy Christmas. And then he breaks the fourth wall and wishes the audience at home a Happy Christmas as well. And so I have a clip of that for us to listen to.
Okay, let's listen to that now.
Here we are. What's this? Well, we so rarely get a chance to celebrate, but this time, we must.
Celebrate?
Yes. It's Christmas. Don't you remember the police station, Christmas?
So it was, yes.
Here's a toast, a happy Christmas to all of us.
Send you, Doctor. Sarah.
Incidentally, a happy Christmas to all of you at home.
Wasn't that cool?
That's great. That's great to hear the first Doctor and to hear him wish us a Merry Christmas. It is unusual. It seems to have that breaking of the fourth wall. I mean, that's something that just isn't. I don't think it's ever done now on TV. But it's kind of fun to kind of look back and just to realize how old this series really is. To kind of be confronted by that reality.
Incidentally, if people want to see a version of that episode, the episode itself is lost, but they had a guy back in the 60s who did what were called telesnaps for archival purposes. He would point a camera at the screen and take a picture every few seconds. And so someone has matched up a bunch of telesnaps with the original soundtrack of that episode, which does survive. And it's on YouTube. If you want to watch it, it's Doctor Who, The Feast of Stephen. is the name of the episode. And there should be a link to the episode in the show notes.
We'll make sure to get that in the show notes. Did they film those live, Jimmy, or were they... because I haven't seen any of those old versions, so I'm not even sure it would have been possible to film it live. But were they recorded or live?
Yeah. They were recorded. I think something scratching my memory says they might have had to do a little bit of it live occasionally in emergency circumstances. But no, as a special effects show with lots of sci-fi sets and stuff, they pre-recorded them.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, if the Adventure in Space and Time, the series about the establishment of Doctor Who, or the special that about when Doctor Who was established, is to believe, it was generally recorded within weeks of broadcast, so within like at most a month before broadcast. Wow. So as they're broadcasting one episode, they're already filming like three or four episodes ahead. But it's not like, you know, now where they have the whole season done, they're doing all the posts, they're doing all the editing, and then they put it out.
Right.
In fact, the hectic production schedule they had at the time would cause issues because the actors needed breaks. And, you know, someone could get sick or they just needed a vacation. And so when you're doing an episode almost every week of the year, that can cause scheduling issues. And so one of the things you find when you watch the early years is that sometimes the Doctor or one of his companions will just vanish for an episode. And they have some on-screen explanation like, oh, Zoe is off exploring this other area today, but that's not where our story is set. Or Jamie is in has been captured, and that's why he's not on the show this week. But they found ways to work around the actors' schedules in order to do that.
Wow. Just the idea of 40 to 50 episodes a year, that just is mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And much shorter, half hour, 20 some odd minutes, half hour. Yeah. Okay, so from 50 years ago to today, we look at, in fact, exactly 50 years later, our 2015 episode, The Husbands of River Song, which features prominently, of course, our character here, River Song, who I suppose some would say, you know, in some cases or some circles, she's somewhat controversial. Some think she's a bit of a deus ex machina or she swoops in, saves the day sort of thing. But nevertheless, let's just get a quick synopsis of what happens in this episode, and then we can kind of go through it. And as we go, we can kind of bring up any of the issues or any of the interesting bits that we experienced as we watched. So the show opens. The Doctor is on the planet Mendarax Delora in the year 5343. I just comment, he spends a lot of time in the 51st, 52nd, 53rd century, incidentally, but in the most recent series of these of the show. So he's asked by a man named Nardol to follow him, who Nardol thinks he's a surgeon. You know, there's a bit of a little slapstick Three's Company mistaken identity thing going on there. He's been sent by River Song to find this surgeon that she's contracted with. The surgeon's required to remove a diamond, a priceless diamond, the highest priced diamond in the universe, from the head of King Hydroflax after he had attempted to steal it and ended up being projectiled into his head. And River wants to recover it for her own purposes. The Doctor is surprised that River doesn't recognize him in this face that she has not seen yet. She's not been in an episode with this current Doctor. And so the Doctor kind of goes through the episode trying to reveal to her that it's me, I'm the Doctor, and she just resolutely fails to identify him. And in the meantime, kind of sees how she acts when he's not there, including things that she says about him and things she does with the TARDIS. They both encounter this idea that this River is finding that her time is drawing a close, as she assumes that her diary is getting that he gave her is being filled, and he's the sort of person who gives a diary of the exact right length for a life. They end up going from the snow planet to a cruise ship, where they're going to make the she's going to sell this diamond.
A cruise ship in space.
Yes, a cruise ship in space, which we have seen before. We've in a previous. I was struck by the similarities to the Voyage of the Damned Christmas episode of 2007, in which David Tennant's Doctor was also on a cruise ship in space. This one, the Titanic. They had similar fates. The cruise ship, the Titanic, ironically, is the one that survived. This one does not. It crashes on a planet. River and the Doctor survive, of course. The planet is Deryllium, a planet mentioned in a previous episode as a place where the Doctor and River spent their last night together before she died in the episode Silence in the Library. And then they spend a night together in a restaurant built at the Towers of Deryllium, built by and financed by the Doctor, with the most priceless diamond in the world. So that's this is quite a lot being summed up in that little summary. Couple things that to mention right off the bat for me is the news that Stephen Moffat, the producer, head writer, showrunner, says that he wrote this episode thinking that it could be his last. Apparently, there was some dispute with BBC over whether they would renew his contract at the rate levels he wished. It sounds like, you know, a little brinksmanship or whatever. But there was a possibility it could be his last, and so he wrote this in such a way that it would tie up some of his favorite elements, favorite characters. To pass it on to the next showrunner, and that would, which would be, you know, this, you know, evidently ties up the story of River Song, which is she's played a prominent part in throughout his tenure as showrunner. So, did anybody else hear that that it was Moffat's last? How did you feel about that news that it would possibly could have been his last episode, Jimmy?
Well, I was surprised. I guess that was the main thing I felt, because I hadn't heard any previous indication that he might be imminently going. A few years ago, he did make a comment that he was probably closer to the end of his time on the show than to the beginning, but then he got Peter Capaldi to play with, and that seemed to make all of that go away. And so I hadn't heard until he made this comment that he might have actually left at the end of this season. I'd be curious to know a little bit more about why. Presumably it had something to do with contract negotiations. It'll be interesting when he does go, because he's really shaped the show for the last number of years. And he has a certain sensibility to his stories that sometimes I really like. But other times I don't. It's a kind of fairy tale sensibility, and I think he goes over the line at times, and the plot holes are a little too gaping for me at times. And so I'd be interested to see. I mean, I like his work. I don't dislike it in substance. But I'd also be interested to see what another showrunner would do and whether they might take it in a little bit less of a fairy tale direction.
So Moffat has kind of had a love-hate relationship with the fans. I mean, he loves the fans, apparently, or at least he always said so. But the fans kind of... There's a strong divide among fans, and frankly, inside some fans, like you say, Jimmy. Stephanie, what do you think about Stephen Moffat as the showrunner? I just want to kind of take this a little bit of a tangent right at the beginning here, just because it comes up. But Stephanie, what do you think of Moffat as his, you know, what he's done with the show? Do you love him? Do you hate him? Something in between?
Well, I have the same kind of sensibility that Jimmy does about him. I've had not that long of an experience with Doctor Who as you have, but I've had mixed feelings about the show for several years now. Some episodes are really good, some episodes not very good, and there seems to be not really anything consistent until these last couple of episodes in season 9 when we finally have some kind of moving forward and telling good stories. And I think I've fallen in love with the show again after almost wanting to quit last season because it was not good for a very number of episodes. So I think it's we're on a good momentum now. So if he can continue that for the next seasons that he's on, great. If he goes backwards, not so good. But we'll see what happens. I would love to have a new showrunner and to have consistency all the time, but I guess we'll just have to see what happens.
How about you, Father Corey? What's your assessment of Moffat and his future?
Well, I definitely prefer having him compared to Russell T. Davies, who restarted the series. I was actually just kind of thinking jokingly, you know, at least with Moffat, he picks planet names and people's names you can actually pronounce. Russell T. Davies got a little too much into the multisyllabic names that were absolutely ridiculous to try to pronounce.
I think he was just picking Welsh names at the time for a
could
while.
It could be. Some of those were ridiculous. They're like 10, 12 syllables, and it's like, how is that even a word? But more of a practical aspect, Russell T. Davies is a little bit of a propagandist. He has propaganda that he wants to put in there, and he did put that in the series. And at least Stephen Moffat keeps most of it out of there. Hmm. He wants to tell a story. You know, like his story, not like his story. Because, yeah, like Jimmy's mentioned before, he likes to do the hand-waving, don't worry about this. You know, think of the Jedi mind trick. You're not going to worry about this plot hole, you know. But I have enjoyed his stories that he tells. And he's allowed some good stories to be told, too. And I think that's part of it, too, is letting other writers in to tell stories. And there have been some very good stories under his tenure. Whether or not he's going to continue or not, you know, obviously, yeah, you know, every time there's a contract negotiation, they have to put out this might be my last season.
Exactly. That seems to be very, very common, especially on Doctor Who, the companions and doctors and producers. It might be my last. So back to the episode then. We begin, it's snowing on this world, Melorax. Something pronounceable. It's interesting. We're thousands of years in the future, but apparently on this colony world of Earth, we can just assume it's a colony of Earth, I suppose. There's an 18th century looking British village where they still sing religious Christmas songs.
I know, we got Hark the Herald Angels Sing. That was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a British TV thing, but in America, they even strip the religious imagery out of the Christmas songs I've seen on some other TV shows in America. But that was a nice touch. So the doctor happens to be on this planet, and this fellow Nardole, you know, is searching for someone. And comes to the TARDIS, knocks on the door, and the doctor, in a doctor way, opens the door with antlers on his head. And before the poor guy can, you know, toy antlers, dress up antlers, you know, accosts the man before he can, you know, say a word. Am I wearing antlers on my head? And then when he said yes, he kind of turns and berates the TARDIS. I thought that was an interesting touch, that he's, you know, trying to cheer him up or something. What do you think? Why do you think the TARDIS was cheering up Jimmy? Was this the TARDIS remembers Clara and is trying to counteract him being alone again?
It could be an element of that. I assume we can probably infer that here, since even though he knows Clara's not dead, he doesn't know how to find her, and so that would be somewhat sad. But also, I think it's just because the Doctor is not a Christmas person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a sign on the door of the TARDIS that says carolers will be criticized. And so he's doing his usual grumpy Scottish Peter Capaldi act. And the TARDIS wants to cheer him up and creates holometric antlers on his head. And I like the way he berates it, saying, you know, you're a time travel machine. You're a vehicle. When did I ask you to cheer me up with hologrammatic antlers?
That's great. So in the meantime, we get this sort of comedy of errors bit where we have a mistaken identity, where this the Nardole is says, "Are you the surgeon?" And the doctor says, "Well, I suppose that's one way to put it." And Nardole whisks him off to this literally flying saucer that's landed outside the village, he takes her to meet Raven, I'm getting my episodes mixed up. I said Raven because I'd made a note that this village looks a lot like the alley where the plot of the Raven episode took place. I don't know if they're just reusing and redressing the set or not, but
it may be the same set, but in this episode we have to face the river.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Instead of facing the Raven. So we have Riven River who doesn't recognize the Doctor. And I assume she's never encountered the 12th Doctor.
She hasn't.
I was right before in our recording here that this is the first instance of River Song in the last two seasons then.
Yes. Yes, it
correct.
Is. Okay. And if you want to put it in her timeline, because you remember from with Matt Smith and David Tennant, she was running backwards from the Doctor's timeline.
Right.
She's now, this is after the library. So she meets David Tennant's Doctor in the library, and this is after that for her.
Well,
no, she dies in the library.
This is just before the library.
Before the library. It's after the episode. Where Amy and Rory get stuck in Manhattan in the 1920s or whatever. So it's right after that for her. They allude to that later in the show. She hasn't seen this Doctor. In fact, she didn't even know there would be this Doctor because she comments about, don't you have a limit on regenerations? And she thought Matt Smith had used them up. Mm. So she's got all those 12 pictures of the Doctor, you know, all of his faces. He's got to look like one of these. And and that's not the case. She hasn't known that he got around the regeneration limit.
Right. In fact, there's what some are saying in maybe the best line of the episode where after, you know, hearing that her husband is inside, which sets him back because he thinks he's her husband. He says, I think I'm going to need a bigger flowchart.
Yeah,
because trying to keep track of their intersecting timelines. And in fact, there is from radiotimes.com. They actually created a flowchart of River's appearances in the various episodes. So River Song's Doctor Who Life in Order. And this, they also link to another one that is a little more complex, looks a little more like the London Underground tube map. But it is complicated, and frankly, time travel gives me a headache. Like the paradoxes of intersecting timelines. So I just kind of like we say, we wave my hand and move on. I don't think too much about it. So we meet River's husband that the Doctor has been called to operate upon, Hydroflax, who King Hydroflax, who is apparently a cyborg. Who is a human head on a robot body, which apparently River Song dropped a spoiler for this in the episode The Pandorica Opens. I don't know if anybody recalls that.
I recall the episode. I don't recall the spoiler.
She says in the episode, after she's rescued from the exploding TARDIS and finds that Rory is plastic, she comments that she had a boyfriend with a swappable head once.
Oh,
which is right. So I'm going to guess that Moffat is reaching back to pull that bit. There was a lot of moments like this in this episode where there's these little tiny tidbits that looks like it's like he's reached back to grab from before. So the swappable head.
Interestingly, that wouldn't fit with her timeline, but it's probably something that he did reach back to grab just for fun.
Right. Right. He apparently tried to steal this diamond, the most expensive diamond in the universe, and it backfired on him, and such that the diamond was shot like a projectile into his head, and so it needs to be removed. And
can I register just a complaint about writing at that point?
Yes, please.
I'm willing to concede this diamond has somehow been shot into his head. Fine. Why does it have to be the most expensive in the universe? I mean, it sucks the life out of dramas if you are always dealing with superlatives. Yes. It could just be a very expensive diamond. That's all we need. It's sloppy writing to always go to the superlative case.
Right. Well, you know, once you have an alien, for example, that's going to destroy the galaxy, well, the next time the alien has to destroy the universe, and then and then what next? Like, exactly. Yeah, I call it sort of a Star Trek problem. You know, the Klingons were horrible until they were our allies, and so we met the Ferengi, which was a joke. And then, you know, you always just got to come up with the next big bad enemy that you've got to defeat. So it's certainly not confined to Doctor Who, but it's a problem.
What's better, more successful writing does is it periodically rescales the drama on a smaller scale so that when you go big, it feels like it has weight. But if you spend all your time at the limiting case, then it ends up not being as powerful as if you vary the level.
Exactly. Yes, true. I'm thinking of several cases of that, you know, the most secure bank in the galaxy and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, very interesting. So the Doctor's jealous. Do you notice this? And you have to kind of wonder why he has cause to be jealous. I mean, certainly, you know, the heart does what the heart wills, but he's jealous even though he's had these other relationships through the years and the episodes, which does come up. What do you think motivates his jealousy at this point? Is it purely I have affection for River and she's showing to someone else, or is there a little bit more of a ego here where I should be the most important man in her life, even though I've not really shown the same regard back to her? What do you think?
I think it's both of those and the desire to have comedy. Showing the Doctor being jealous is comedy. So
okay. So we have this back and forth with the Doctor and River. He actually throws out this rant about carrying the weight of the upper class on his back. You know, saying he can't bow before King Hydroflax because of the it's I'm tired or my back is hurt from carrying the upper class. It sounds very Scottish, doesn't it? The way he says it, the sort of Scottish independence a little bit. He's taken aback by the fact that she's talking about murdering a man. How do you feel about this? About River kind of openly and brazenly kind of just admitting to, yes, we're going to murder this man. She kind of gives a bit of a defense that Hydroflax is a horrible, horrible person.
Yeah, he's basically Space Hitler.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, are we okay with that? Does that detract from her character that we know of her in the past? What do you, Father Corey? What do you think? I mean, does it hurt at all? I mean, given that this is a Christmas episode and thus it tends to be fluffy and fun.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the episode is concerned, yeah, it kind of takes away from the frivolousness of the episode. I mean, because there is a lot of that in there. I don't think it takes away from her character so much. She's shown herself to be ruthless when necessary, when she deems it necessary. She's shown herself to be kind of a free agent who's willing to do whatever it takes, whenever it takes, and however it takes, sometimes to the consternation of the Doctor.
Right. So
I think though there is an element of discomfort, and not just with King Hydroflax, but with all the people who are on board the Starliner too, because we're told that, you know, they're basically all genocidal, homicidal maniacs, and who are just fabulously wealthy. And that the reason for that on the plot level is to set us up for what happens at the end, where the starship crashes and they all die. And they need to not have the Doctor and River be able to save the ship. They need to fail, so they're the only two survivors. Mm-hmm. And we need to not feel terrible that they failed to save all of these people. And the way to do that, according to this episode, is, well, the other people were really all horrible. So it's like that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger where he's asked, you know, have you ever killed anybody? And he says, yes, but they were all bad.
Exactly.
And that's basically what we have going on here. But still, for a Christmas episode, there's an element of discomfort there. But and personally, I kind of wish they had done something different, but I don't think it's a total failure. It is possible to do farces that involve very weighty subjects. I mean, Gilbert and Sullivan's opera, The Mikado, is hilariously funny, but it deals with issues like suicide and totally unjust capital punishment.
Right.
And so, so you can kind of, in fact, a lot of comedy is playing with uncomfort levels.
Yeah,
and
the black comedy.
Testing them, yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's an element of that here. I don't think it totally fails, but I don't think it totally succeeds either.
I mean, I could see where River is setting up this plot, this caper. She seeks out a moment in time in a place where a boatload, literally, of the most evil people in the galaxy are going to die, separate from what from her agency. It just happens to occur while she's there, and so she chooses that time and place as a time traveler for this to occur. I could see that, you know, of all time and space, that's the place to go and the place to be at that time. I could see that, I suppose. But you're right. It is mighty convenient, and it's done to sort of save the Doctor from being involved in something that... Because for crying out loud, even the crew, they say, is, you know, you have to be a crew, you have to be a depraved murderer. So, you know, so even the crew, we don't feel bad about going down with the ship. We're trying to be a lighthearted, a bit of a farce. So there's a couple other, you know, jumping back a bit, a couple very interesting things. I don't know if anyone noticed that she pulled a red fez out of her bag, but which yep. she's trying to get it ready to put the hat in, the head in. Sorry. A lot of funny scenes with that. She comes up with a lot of sort of feminist zingers. I don't know if you noticed that things like, "Are you thinking? You're a man. That's weird."
Yeah.
Things like. Things like that. She actually, and then at one point she refers to her second wife. You mentioned Father Corey. You know, the Russell T. Davies had an agenda. I mean, this is a Moffat has sometimes hinted at this sort of gender bending stuff with Missy and Clara, and I mean he's brought this in several times this season.
Right. He's not as explicit yeah. about it as Russell T. Davies was. It's one of those, he'll throw the one-liner out there and just leave it.
Yeah.
I think gay marriage jokes and gay jokes are just sort of the British equivalent of fart jokes. They're tasteless, okay. But they seem popular at the moment right. for some reason.
Okay. That's a good analogy. So we'll just let that lie then and just move on from there. River pulls out her sonic device.
A trowel.
Well, I suppose, you know, Indiana Jones would have a sonic trowel too, an archaeologist.
I love the Doctor's reaction. You know, a sonic trowel. Do you realize how stupid that sounds? Of course, a sonic screwdriver sounds just as stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
or even better, as sonic sunglasses, which he does pull out again in this episode. So he's not abandoned the sunglasses altogether.
It looks like they're almost going to get used more like David Tennant's 3D glasses.
Right. which was weird.
The sensor glasses, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which didn't even, weren't supposed to do something. But so moving on from there, we meet Ramon, who also was apparently a husband of River Song, although he doesn't remember it because she wiped his memory, because as she says, he got weird about it.
So we're up to three husbands now in this episode, so they fulfilled the title.
Yes. To have a minimum of three husbands in order for it to seem it's worth that title. She says that they're looking for the Doctor, that they planned this event on this planet because it was the closest intersection with the Doctor's timeline. And she has a code name for the Doctor, which is humorous. The first of many digs she makes on the Doctor in this episode. She calls him the damsel in distress is her code name for him because he needs rescuing.
I also love the fact that she's apparently been borrowing the TARDIS without him noticing for a long time.
And how angry he gets at that. And you can see he's visibly disturbed by the fact that she's apparently been taking it and bringing it back when he's not looking. Yes. In some ways, you know, more than anyone else, River feels like a match for the Doctor, even more so maybe than Missy slash the Master, because that's a little different Time Lord sort of thing. But
yeah,
this is
they're brothers, so it's
yeah,
a different dynamic.
Yeah, this is, she just feels like a like she's like a real like a on wit and intelligence and derring do, a real match for him in this relationship. So she they go inside and then she tells him to brace himself before he comes in. And for me, this is my favorite part of the episode.
Oh yeah,
where he says finally. And so, because finally he gets to pretend to be properly to be shocked by the TARDIS being bigger on the inside, and he goes through these gyrations and this gaping at this the interior. My whole concept of time and space has been thrown out the door. I loved it. I mean, for me, this is my favorite part of the episode.
Yeah, it's just, and it's kind of funny too, where she completely misses the sarcasm in the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, she just, it goes completely over her head. She just looks annoyed by the whole deal. It's like, okay, get on with it already.
Even as she goes to the hidden stash, the hidden liquor cabinet in the main control room.
Yeah.
Incidentally, this is the first time the Doctor's had a chance to play that. But we have had some very interesting previous takes on reactions to the TARDIS besides it's bigger on the inside, you know, which is the classic thing everyone says. There have been alternatives. There are a couple of them spring to mind. One is in an old episode of Doctor Who where one of the unit soldiers, a regular character named Sergeant Benton, gets inside the TARDIS for the first time and doesn't say anything. And the Doctor turns to him and says, aren't you going to comment about how it's bigger on the inside? And he says, well, that seems pretty obvious, doesn't it? and then another, which is one of my favorites, is in the Christmas special that Clara appeared in as a 19th century governess, where she comes in, she sees the inside of the TARDIS, she gapes at it, she exits, runs around the TARDIS, and comes back in and says, it's smaller on the outside.
I guess that works. He says, I'm like, I guess that works. Or
yeah.
That is good. That is good. there's a funny bit where she says, don't press that button. He's trying to help her drive the TARDIS. And she's saying, no, no, no. And he says, well, what about that button? Shouldn't you press that button? She says, no, that evacuates the waste tanks on deck 7. And he kind of says an aside, I think I'll avoid deck 7 for a while.
He's apparently been pushing that button.
If Moffat is good, he's good at writing this funny stuff, and I got to give it to him. So they get to the cruise ship that is named Harmony and Redemption, which is a funny name for a cruise ship carrying genocidal maniacs. But does it have a deeper meaning? I mean, her name is as we know, her birth name is Melody Pond, and her name now is River Song. Is Harmony and Redemption, is there a bigger or deeper significance to it, or is that looking too deep on Doctor Who? Anyone?
I took it as just a reference to what the genocidal maniacs want. This is a place for them to be in harmony. They're not going to kill each other there, and everybody wants a shot at redemption.
Okay,
That was kind of my thought as well.
All right.
Incidentally, we know where this ship is because, or at least could, if you want to think about it, because they announced that they're on a tour of several galaxies, and their next galaxy is going to be the Andromeda Galaxy.
That's right.
And we can infer from the background image, which is the Eye of God Nebula, that they're here in the Milky Way because that's where the Eye of God Nebula is. And so it's also, it may be thinking about it too much, but here we have these genocidal maniacs being watched by the Eye of God.
That would be, I mean, that could be just a special effects guy putting the Eye of God Nebula in the background, but that would be really, that's still pretty good. And they're traveling apparently at warp factor 12, which is, I guess they have warp factors at that time in place in time and space, just like Star Trek. So they're still. It's funny when they get on board because they're in the hold, and she grabs his hand and pulls him out, and he says, "Stop holding my hand. People don't do that to me." I found that funny as a Star Trek fan, having seen Star Trek: The Force Awakens, how the "stop holding my hand" bit came up because that was the same sort of thing. We actually had that in Star Trek, where spoilers, everyone, spoilers, sweetie. There's a point at which the character Rey has her hand grabbed by the character Finn, and she's like, "Why are you holding my hand?
Just ruined it for me, dude."
No, I'm sorry. That was actually the linchpin of the whole movie. It's the hand holding thing.
All I can say is it's been a month. Too late.
Father Roderick is already up to 7 viewings. I mean, if you got to catch up here.
By the way, there's a cartoon from the XKCD online comic that deals with that after a week, spoilers become the responsibility of the one spoiled, not the one spoiling.
That's good. He refers to he's got the head in the bag, which is very upset, the head of King Hydroflax, which was apparently detachable, we learned.
By the way, they're subverting a common crime drama trope, because heads in bags are a common feature in crime dramas.
Yes.
And here we have one that talks and threatens people and for comedic purposes, and it just totally subverts that trope.
Right down to the doctor blaming it on the noise coming from the bag on his irritable bowel, which... Oh, boy. Just... I'm sorry. I'm still a little boy at heart. The potty humor gets me, is funny.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then we go to dinner with River Song and the doctor and a ship full of genocidal maniacs. And we have an actually interesting little interlude between them, a little character moment here. She says to him, "Why are you frowning?" And he says, "How do you know I'm frowning?" And she says, "It's audible." Again, we kind of referring to this particular doctor's personality, which is so grumpy that everyone notices it.
The attack eyebrows are in effect.
Exactly. And she kind of talks about, you know, the doctor. He kind of, you know, starts eliciting from her some of the commentary on the doctor, and she talks about how the doctor, you know, men will, you know, it's easy to make men fall in love with you. They'll believe any story they're the hero of, and so she seems very cynical at this point. Stephanie, do you take that as is she truly cynical, or is she telling a tale for this stranger? In order to throw him off the scent, or is she lying to herself? How do you take this moment with River Song's interaction with the doctor?
I think it's a little bit of all of those. She's just really trying to, she's telling a story to this guy that she doesn't know him, and telling him things that have happened in the past, and maybe lying to herself a little bit, lying to him. I think it's a combination.
She even at one point, doesn't she say something like, she's asked about the doctor without him being named, was he that special? And she says no. And that's clearly a lie on her part.
Yeah, she says he's not somebody special, but terribly useful now and then.
Yeah, and that's not River's real view of the doctor. That's maybe something she tells herself in a cynical moment, but she's obviously madly in love with him and is so in love with him, she doesn't even mind that he's not reciprocally in love with her, in her opinion. Mm-hmm. But then it turns out later, because the test of that is he would never put himself in this danger with me, when he's standing right there. So we have an indication the doctor cares about River more than River thinks he does.
Yeah, she says the doctor doesn't go around falling in love with people. But as we've seen in nine seasons just here, I'm not sure about previously, he does go around, you know, with Rose, whatever he felt for Martha Jones, but there's some kind of relationship. And then Clara, obviously, and River herself, you know, he does go around falling in love.
He's a falling in love person.
Yes.
Yep.
She says loving the doctor is like loving the stars themselves. She kind of puts him on this pedestal, this unattainable. He's so far above all the rest of us. This seems to be a sort of a feature of the doctor I hate to overemphasize the difference between Moffat and Russell T. Davies, but this seems to be a feature of the Doctor under Moffat, which is he's this larger than life godlike figure in the universe, whereas Davies he wasn't exactly small, but he was. Some people knew of him. He had a bit of a reputation, but he wasn't this known figure throughout all of time and space. Do we see a difference there? Or am I imagining that?
I think there is a difference, but I think there's also a commonality. Russell T. Davies had the Doctor's larger than life in every incarnation because he's the hero of the show. But under Russell T. Davies, we had him referred to as a lonely god, and he also was known as by the Daleks as the oncoming storm, and he plays that up in a really big threatening way. I'm the oncoming storm, and so I think there's a similarity there. But what's different is that Moffat then took that concept and thought about the practical implications of that, because if you really are that well known, then you can use that to your advantage. And so in Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead, the first River Song episodes, at the climax to defeat the Vashta Narada, the Doctor says, "We're in the biggest library in the universe." There's another superlative, by the way.
Yes.
Look me up. And that's all he has to do to get them to back off. And so Moffat realized, though, that once Matt Smith came on, Moffat carried that forward to where you have in the Pandorica Opens, you have Matt Smith standing at Stonehenge defying a sky of full of hostile aliens with no plan. And he just talks them into a standoff by saying, who's going to be the first to try to come at me?
Right.
And Moffat realized you can't do that indefinitely. He had the brains to realize that, which is good. So he then pulled it back, and the Doctor notes, "I got too big," and he starts wiping memory of himself from different data banks in the universe so we could go back to smaller scale stories again that just happen to involve the most expensive diamond in the universe.
With the worst homicidal maniacs.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Great. While you were saying that, I was remembering also Water of Mars as a Russell T. Davies
Time Lord
episode.
Triumph?
Time Lord or Triumph or Victorious or something like that. Yeah, where he basically claims to I'm the master of life and death, and by the way, he was disproved in that moment as the commander of that mission took her own life despite him saving her.
That illusion got punctured by a bullet.
Yes,
yeah,
yes,
exactly.
very powerful moment. So we have the amazing head-splitting aliens who come to buy the diamond. That was gross, and as he says, not something you should do at the dinner table.
Yeah.
and some MacGuffin device that apparently accesses every bank in the universe. And we find out that they actually worship King Hydroflax, and that's a very awkward moment, which they then have to talk themselves out of. They determine that rather than the head of the king of King Hydroflax, this robot who wants to be king determines that the best head for it would now be the Doctor's.
And he comes to that conclusion because he's been influenced by the Mater D, who I really liked in this episode. I thought the actor did he's under all this insect makeup, but I really thought the Mater D was a great character. He has a really nice combination of obsequiousness and pleasantness and also ruthlessness.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that character was really nice.
Yeah, and at this moment, as he reads from River's diary, I should back up a second and mention that River while they're sitting at the table, River pulls out her diary and he asks her why she's sad. And she says it's because the diary is almost full, and the man who gave it to her, the doctor she's referring to, knows how long a diary should be.
Yeah, except what we now know is that that's just inference on her part, and it's not reliable because the doctor didn't know that this was when she was going to die. He did not give her a diary of a certain length, so it would run out when her life did.
Right, right. In fact, she's kind of built him up to be even more than he is in that sense. We have this moment with they want the head of the doctor. They hit by this meteor. They make a run for it. Now, there's a great moment where the robot is confronting the doctor, and the doctor has to get rid of the robot. And so I'm not exactly sure how to describe it. So he takes this little device that's supposed to let the robot connect to every bank in the universe.
Yeah, he bribes the robot. He offers it a huge financial bribe in the form of the little device, which will connect the robot to every bank. But he's really tricking the robot, because as soon as the robot tries to access those, it's going to become the target of all the security software the banks have.
Right.
And
right.
So the robot is then disabled by all the security software the banks are using.
So and actually this leads to I think the one is a sort of a breaking of the fourth wall, where the doctor jokes, oh, he had a bad day on the market, stops, comes back, and kind of says to the character that he's talking to on screen, the extra, but I felt like he was really talking to the audience, apologizing for the cheesy joke. That's the voice of Moffat to the fans, apologizing. I know that was a bad joke. Let's just move on.
There's another nice bit in there too, where the robot, as it's being disabled by the security software, it says, "I don't understand," and the doctor says, "Just like most people." And that's so true, because I mean, when I hear financial reports on the news, I have barely any understanding of what they're talking about.
So we go to the bridge as they're trying to save the ship, keep it from crashing, the doctor and River. And there's this banter back and forth as they kind of bicker over husbands and wives that they've each had. And we get this interesting list. Is anyone surprised by any of the names on the list?
Stephen Fry.
Yeah, apparently River was married to Stephen Fry, which the doctor responds, same as Cleopatra, which is sort of the same as Cleopatra, which I thought was kind of funny.
Or she says Cleopatra, and he says same thing, which I took to mean they both married Cleopatra or something like that.
Or maybe a reference to Stephen Fry's sexual preferences.
That's probably the more likely.
I thought that might be. So we knew about Elizabeth I, of course, in the Day of the Doctors.
50th. That was the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. Is that Day of the Doctors or Time of the Doctors?
Day of the Doctor.
Day of the Doctors. Day of the Doctor. Okay, mental block against remembering that.
I think everybody does, because they gave us the Night of the Doctor, the Day of the Doctor, and the Time of the Doctor all in rapid succession, and it's kind of hard to keep them apart.
Now, apparently, the marriage to Marilyn Monroe was in an episode.
Yeah, well, it is sort of. It's in the Christmas Carol Christmas episode, where at one point the Doctor takes. Do I have that right? Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, he takes the little boy to Kazdan Sardik to Earth for Christmas, and it's the 1950s, and they're in Las Vegas, and we don't see Marilyn Monroe, but he's talking to her. Apparently, they're going to go to a Las Vegas wedding chapel and get married, and then later on, he says that was never a proper chapel, putting some doubt over was this a real marriage or not.
Okay, okay. Which apparently is a problem in the Doctor Who universe, valid marriages.
Yeah. they don't really take that overly seriously.
Well, you have to wonder whether the getting married in a bubble universe where time has stopped is grounds for a valid marriage. But
by the way, I could be I'm not 100% sure that was the Christmas episode. It may have been a different one, but okay. That's the essence of what happens.
Okay. Okay. There's this funny back and forth where they're trying to chasing each other in and out of the TARDIS on the bridge of the ship, and the ship crashes. And while River is recovering from what must be a nasty concussion, the doctor steps outside, sees where they are. They've crash landed next to the Singing Towers of Deryllium, which right. we've heard from before, heard about before.
Yeah, and we first heard about them in Forest of the Dead, where River Song dies back during Matt Tennant's days. She tells the Doctor that we spent our last night at the Singing Towers of Deryllium, and you gave me your sonic screwdriver, and you wept, and I didn't know why, but it must have been because you knew I was going to my death now. And so it all harks back to that initial River Song episode. Then she reminds us in this one of some of that. When the spaceship is crashing, she says, I recognize that planet. That's Deryllium. I keep asking you to take me to the Singing Towers, but you keep begging off at the last minute. And she even refers to a time when there were two of the Doctors, and he bailed on going to Deryllium. And that's something we've actually seen if you watch the bonus features on the DVDs, because they did a series of mini episodes, which you can also find on YouTube, where back during the Matt Smith era, where Matt Smith was spending a night on the TARDIS and he encountered an alternate version of himself that had River Song in tow. And as they're leaving, River notes that her version of the Doctor is about to take her to the Singing Towers of Deryllium. And the two Doctors share this kind of knowing moment. And so if they'd never made this episode, that would have served as the link to the end of River's storyline. But because they did make this episode, that's now reclassified as one of the occasions where he bailed at the last minute.
Okay. Now that you mention it, I do remember. Did either of you see that, Stephanie or Father Corey?
No, I missed that one.
It's a funny little interlude. Worth just seeking out, like you say, Jimmy. It's on YouTube. So
yeah, it's a two-parter. So just be aware of that for anyone who wants to look it up. It's worth taking a look at. It fills in a little bit more of the background to this episode.
And it's short, 10, 15 minutes, something like that.
Oh, yeah. Less than that.
Yeah, even less. Yep. So, and like you said, so he encounters a rescue worker outside the crashed ship and says, this would be a nice place to build a restaurant, which would seem to be an incongruous thing to say at the site of a crashed ship where thousands of people died.
Well, the Singing Towers are right there.
Well, they are, yes. And we should forget about the bad thing that happened and build something beautiful. So he hands over the diamond, the most expensive diamond in the universe, to this fellow. And he says to him, there's a big reward for its return. So that's nice. He doesn't make him complicit in a crime. Goes forward in time till the restaurant is built, makes a reservation for several years in the future from that. And then they show up and he's there wearing his suit that she also mentions in the Forest of the Dead, I think. The last time she saw him,
he had a new haircut and a suit.
Yes. And so there he is in the suit. And we have
the regeneration supplies the new haircut.
Exactly.
Right. we had this nice moment between them, or at least I think so. He has this tear. He cries. She asks why he's sad. He says not everything can be avoided. But she says, she kind of begs him, there's always a loophole. And yet he goes into this mode that the Doctor sometimes get where he's very fatalistic. You know, every night is the last night for someone. Every Christmas is the last Christmas. That harkens back, doesn't it?
It does. It also harkens back to the speech that Clara just gave him.
Mm-hmm.
When she was about to face the Raven, she has this, you're going to find some loophole speech. And now River's doing the same thing. And in both cases, there was and wasn't a loophole.
Right. So that's an interesting possible clue, or it gives a little loophole for Stephen Moffat. What does he say? Happy ever after is a lie we tell ourselves because the truth is so hard. And she says,
that's just depressing.
It is. Well, she says, happy ever after doesn't have to mean forever. It just means time, a little time.
Right.
A doctor says another nice line, always when you need it the most, there is a song. And, you know, there's two levels to that. There's he's referring on the surface level to the Towers of Deryllium playing their music, but also to River. And then, you know, she thinks, oh, well, you know, the song, apparently the towers only sing at night. And then she says, well, how long is the night on this planet? And he says, oh, 24 years. Just kind of drops that.
there's our semi loophole.
Yeah, exactly.
And she actually, in Forest of the Dead, she says, oh, what a night that was. Well, of course, if it was 24 years long.
No kidding.
So do we believe that...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do we believe that they spent 24 years together on Deryllium in the night, or do they part ways and go on for 24 more years?
I assume that it's that they spent 24 years together on Deryllium with some field trips. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see. I mean, we could get a future River Song adventure on the show, although there's no need for that now. But if they had a great story, they could. But I suspect, in fact, we already are getting River Song stories from Big Finish Productions.
Right.
And so I would expect to see some set in the context of that night.
Yeah, and Big Finish Productions, they do audio storios.
Licensed audio plays that are considered more or less canonical.
Okay. Yeah.
By the way, I wanted to mention, in terms of the Singing Towers, we actually have something like that on Earth. It's not as dramatic as it is with the Singing Towers, but it's similar. So the doctor says the towers blow because, I guess, of temperature inversions with the wind and the cave system underneath them, and it creates this sound. Okay, well, guess what we have in Egypt? Near the city of Luxor, or ancient Thebes, there are a pair of giant statues known as the Colossi of Memnon. They're statues, if I recall correctly, of Amenhotep II, who was a pharaoh about 1400 years BC. And so he had these two statues made of him. They are about 60 feet tall, and just before the turn of the millennium in 27 BC, there was an earthquake that damaged one of the statues. And after that damage occurred, it sang, and we have records of it singing. What it would sing within an hour or two of dawn on some occasions when the weather was right. It was apparently some kind of temperature wind inversion thing that would cause it to make a noise. And it became a popular tourist destination. And so we have graffiti, for example, from not only do we have mentions of the singing in literary records, but we also have graffiti where tourists came and noted, did they hear the sound or not? And so we actually have a kind of – or did have a kind of singing tower here on Earth. Unfortunately, about the year 200, they did some repair work on the statue, and that apparently stopped the singing. Huh. But oh, wow. For about 200 years, we actually had a singing tower here on Earth.
Interesting.
Now, see, I was going to talk about in Marblehead, Massachusetts, there is a beach called Singing Beach, where the shape of the sand granules is such that when you walk on it, it squeaks. And so there's this, it's really Squeaky Beach, but, you know, they call it Singing Beach, but maybe this, not quite the same thing. So I'll go with the Singing Amenhotep statue. Good. So, how did you feel about this final scene? In this apparently beautiful restaurant at the Towers of Deryllium. How did you feel about this wrap up of the story of River Song, Stephanie? How did you feel about the character and this and how we? Let's just assume we're wrapping her up as for now and not worry about loopholes for the future.
Well, I've been a huge fan of the character from. Actually, probably actress as well for a long time. So I was very happy when I saw her on the show, although her storyline has been a bit muddled and kind of strange at times. But I've really enjoyed her as a character. So I think they did a really great job with giving her maybe one last adventure, if this is really going to be it, giving her own sonic screwdriver so she can go off and do her own adventures. And so I think it was a pretty good ending for her.
How about you, Father Corey? How did you feel about this?
Yeah, I guess I pretty much agree. I mean, it was written as a we're done with her now type episode. You know, I hate to put it that way, but that's really kind of how it in some ways it seemed like it. You know, we're going to close off her character. We're going to close the loop. We're going to close the circle. We started with her, you know, back in David Tennant's time. Now we're going to close off with her now. And I thought it did a good job of doing that. Of course, it was a good adventure. You know, it was a fun adventure and everything. But yeah, it definitely did have that feeling of, you know, we've completed her storyline.
Hmm. How about you, Jimmy? The end of River Song.
I really like the character of River Song. I loved the way she was introduced. I think it's a great concept for a character, a companion from the Doctor's future, who actually knows more than he does about stuff. That's a great upending of the usual formula. I think that Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead are two of the best episodes ever produced of Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. If I'm introducing someone to the series, those are the two episodes I'll sit them down and show them, just because they're so awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad we had a chance to pay off River's storyline, because we've been waiting for this. We've known the end of her story from the beginning. And right. So the question is, how do we get there? What's it going to look like when we see it? And I'm glad they paid it off in grand fashion and not just with the DVD bonus feature. I liked many aspects of her storyline overall. Some of them I thought were infected by silliness and I didn't like them as much. But overall, I think the fundamental concept for the character is really good. They could have improved the execution, but I really like the character. I like the actress, and I like the way that it subverts the usual Doctor companion trope. And I like this finale, too. I kind of had a question in my mind about the first time I saw the episode about, okay, so would the Doctor really acquiesce and set up the restaurant like this and make the booking for the two of them, because he knows he's sending River to her death. And he could have said, oh, so we've landed on Deryllium finally and River's unconscious, let's program a new destination before she wakes up. But the Doctor has a sense. I mean, he knows everybody dies eventually. He can't delay this forever. And now that fate has actually brought him to the foot of the Singing Towers of Deryllium with River, he just kind of accepts it and goes along and cooperates, knowing they're going to have a 24-year night together. And I can buy it from that perspective. He's more he's not engineering her death. He's acquiescing to fate.
So as we fade to black, we get on the screen and they lived happily ever after, which blows away progressively. Ever after first, and then and they lived, and then happily leaving last. Significance? Yeah. Is it teasing us? Maybe it's not ever after. Maybe this is just for now. Any thought to significance for that?
Go ahead, Father Corey.
I was going to say, I saw it kind of playing off the where they talked about there is no happily ever after. You know, and that's why, you know, the ever after blows away. They lived happily for 24 years at least, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then they peel off the they lived part, so because River dies, and but the fundamental thing that's important is the last word, they were happy.
Okay. Yep. So that's this episode. From a more meta perspective of Christmas episodes, I think this might be the first one that I know of that none of it took place on Earth. Christmas Carol. That's right. It was literally a retelling of the Dickens story. Okay, so that's been a while. But also, because I watched Voyage of the Damned just last night, and then this one recently. I'm thinking of the Russell T. Davies ones. You know, the early Russell T. Davies Christmas specials all took place. Aliens over London. Whereas the more recent ones were smaller stories. Again, a little more intimate, not so galaxy changing. Thoughts on that? How does this fit within Christmas specials for you? This one, Stephanie. How is this compared to others for you?
I think it was pretty strong, probably one of my favorites of them all. I'm a huge fan of River Song, so whenever she comes in the story, it's always a better episode for me. But I think it was a very strong episode. I would rate it pretty high with the specials.
How about you, Father Corey?
See, I thought it was kind of interesting where it didn't feel so much as a special to me. You know, it felt like it could have been just a regular episode in a series. You know, there's, I mean, yeah, it was there was, you know, the dramatic, you know, the big, you know, the ultimates, the ultimate diamond, the ultimate this, the ultimate that, but that he's done that in regular episodes too. Again, we talked about the ultimate bank. That was a regular episode.
Right.
So I thought it was kind of interesting where it didn't, it was a Christmas special, but the focus wasn't Christmas. You know, they've had other Christmas episodes where the focus was Christmas, or at least a secular vision of Christmas. So that was kind of interesting.
Or at least Christmas. Yeah, Christmas. There was more Christmas to it. Well, that's actually a very interesting point. How about you, Jimmy, in the pantheon of Christmas specials?
There's a mix of what happens. Sometimes they're more Christmassy than others. Like the very first of the Russell Davies era was like robots invading Britain on Christmas, but Chris, it just happens to be Christmas. It's really about robots invading. Or to go back to 1965, it's Christmas. It just happens to be on Christmas, but we get a romp through a silent movie studio. So there's a mix with how Christmassy it is. The most Christmassy now, and I don't like all the Christmas episodes. I thought the snowman episode, I hated it. That's the one that had Clara in the 19th century. I didn't like it at all. Even more than that, I hated the Lion, the Witch, and the Dot and the Wardrobe episode. I thought that was terrible. I mean, it had okay bits, but overall, I really didn't like it. The one I loved is A Christmas Carol. I thought that one was brilliant. I'm not a big fan of the original Dickens story. But I love seeing it done with time travel technology instead of just time travel fantasy. And I thought that was I thought that's the best one ever. I wouldn't say this is the best one ever, but I really enjoyed it. And I liked seeing it because it gave us closure on River Song. And I liked what it did with her arc. And I thought the ending was beautiful. And I really liked that.
Yeah. And for me, comparing this to last year, I really enjoyed last year's Christmas episode. It was much more Christmassy with Nick Frost and the whole gang. I would say as a Christmas episode, I would have rated that one a little higher. But this one, I loved this episode. It was really great as an episode. Mm-hmm. So that's the Doctor Who Christmas special. Now, just as a little on a personal note, anyone get anything good for Christmas that was Doctor Who related?
Ooh, I did.
Okay, Jim, go ahead.
my niece, who is 1 year old, and I guess we don't have a video feed of this, so I can't actually show them to people, but my niece, who is 1 year old, sent me a TARDIS Christmas tree ornament and a book of Doctor Who Mad Libs, as well as a very nice note that she wrote telling me about all the stuff that's going on in her life and how she's learning to walk and how she can now walk like Frankenstein. So congratulations, Ronan Rose.
Well, how about you, Father Corey? Did you get anything Christmassy, Doctor Who related?
Not this year. A couple of years ago, my brother gave me a really cool Doctor Who coffee table book that I've really enjoyed. And then a couple years before that, he gave me some book of some of the scripts from the Fourth Doctor era. So that was kind of fun. That was a lot of fun.
How about you, Stephanie? Anything Doctor Who related?
Not this year. I bought myself a different TARDIS mug a couple years ago.
Oh, nice.
So that's all I have, really.
Well, for me, I got a. I don't know if I'm going to hold this up for my co-hosts to see him at the panel.
Cool.
It's a drawing Firefly. Or a painting. It's from Firefly from the train robbery episode, the train job. Now I promise this is Doctor Who related. So it's but in that episode they use the ship the Serenity to lower a character down to this train that they're going to rob. Well, in this one, being lowered down underneath the Serenity is the TARDIS. So we have it's a TARDIS Firefly mashup picture, which is amazing. It's wonderful, and I can't wait to hang it. I'm still trying to figure out whether to hang it here at home or in my office at work, so I can blow people's mind as they come in to see me at work, as they try to figure out what this nerd is doing now. So I think that's about it, unless we have anything else. We're just, you know, it's going to be a while before we get together again. There's a hiatus. We don't know exactly when Doctor Who, the 10th season, the 10th series for all our British friends, will be coming. We do know that it will be Peter Capaldi as the 10th Doctor. He's hinted, I've seen in reports, that this could be his last season. I don't know how.
Which would be pretty typical. Most doctors stay for 3 years or a little more.
Exactly. Yes. And even if the current seasons are a bit shorter than they have in the past, right now we have about 14 episodes. Even if just a few years ago they were doing half again as many episodes per season. So it could be our last bit of Capaldi. But nevertheless, we'll enjoy what we get. And until then, does anybody have anything else they want to say about this season of Doctor Who or what they expect of the future?
I liked this season more than I liked last one. I thought that taking Peter Capaldi out of the permanent regeneration madness mode and making him a little bit more relatable was good for the series. Mm-hmm. I'm also interested to see who they come up with as a follow-on companion for Clara.
Right.
That would be... That's the big question: is who is the next companion?
Well, the sad thing, you talk about, about every 3 years or so that they change the actor playing the character changes. They do a regeneration. It's kind of the sad part about that is it almost feels like they finally get really comfortable in their skin, so to speak. You finally get comfortable with that character or that actor as the Doctor, and oh, by the way, we're gonna have a new one, and now you got to get comfortable with the new one again.
Yeah. I find it takes me about a season to really love this current Doctor and to get over the grief of the loss of the previous one that happened to me with David Tennant. And then Matt Smith grew on me. And finally, he grew on me and left. And then we had Peter Capaldi, which actually for me, for Capaldi, it was a much quicker turnaround for me. I really did warm to him quickly. But I see what you're saying, Father Corey. It feels like he's just started to really get a grasp on this character. I'd hate to see him move on from it too quickly. But
exactly.
We'll see how that goes. Well, I think that we should wrap it up so that we will keep our promise and make this a shorter show than last time. So with that, I just want to thank my co-hosts on the panel. Stephanie Zimmer, thank you for joining us. Where can people find you when they're not listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who?
You can find me Twitter or Facebook, Angel Steph, ANGELSTPH, and my podcast is TVRewindPodcast.com.
And Jimmy, thanks for coming. Where can people find you?
They can check out my where I work for my day job at Catholic.com, and they can also check out my own website, JimmyAiken.com.
And Father Corey?
Well, you can find me Twitter and Facebook and things like that at Fr Corey Sticha, last name spelled Sticha. And then my website for where I post my homilies as a Catholic priest, I post them at frcorey.org.
And if people want to find me online, they can go to betnet.com, BETTNET.com. Links to all my social media and all my other various places there. For more on The Secrets of Doctor Who and our other fine podcasts, you can go to SQPN.com, the Star Quest Production Network. And until the next time, thank you all for joining us. This has been The Secrets of Doctor Who. And may the TARDIS bring you back home again someday.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later, one of those.